Okay, just bear with me one momento. Well, I am going to just walk through this with you, and you're welcome to stop me if you have a question that comes to mind. You don't have to wait until the very end if you do have something you want to mention. But I know our time is limited, and so what I'd like to do is to just walk through this and then leave time for questions and some discussion at the end if you do have questions. So those of you who know me from having been here before, I've had sort of a series, two series, Unlikely Reformers and Unlikely Deformers. So deformers are usually people who have been born into the church and had been given every advantage and yet strayed, and not only strayed, but in many cases apostated, and had providentially, for whatever reason, garnered a considerable influence. Unlikely reformers are people that are just sort of the opposite, those who have no affiliation whatsoever with biblical Christianity, and yet come to it, and not only do they come to it, but they influence the church in a considerable way. So my subject this morning is Jan Laski, or in the Latin, Johannes Alasco, who was an unlikely reformer. And why or what circumstances made him an unlikely reformer will be made plain as we consider his life and ministry. Laski, as the name suggests, was a Pole, and the Poles were not known for having robustly participated in the Reformation. Although there are exceptions. Count Radziwill, or Radziwill, was a Lithuanian nobleman. He was a fervent Calvinist who worked side by side with the Lutheran churches in his duchy. We're talking here about the early 1500s, the early 16th century. His influence remained largely local, and after the papal nuncio's counter-reformation in Poland largely disappeared by the next generation. During the Reformation, Poland was what might be termed a second-tier kingdom. Luther's doctrines reached those who could read, mainly in the cities, via German merchants. The newly invented printing presses, and there were several in Krakow, were largely run by German craftsmen. And despite attempts to quash the printing of Reformed literature, the presses constantly put them out and distributed them anyway. So there was quite a bit of information available about biblical Christianity, even though there was a lot of resistance against it. Poland, unlike the UK, was for the most part pluralistic when it came to the church, which is kind of interesting given that we're talking about the early 16th century. The king who reigned at the peak of Lutheranism in Poland, Sigismund, walked the fence between worried Roman church bishops and noblemen like Radziwill, who had embraced Protestantism. Both parties formed what was called the Sejm, which is the Polish parliament, and Sigismund's hands-off approach to the Counter-Reformation run by the Jesuits in Poland actually led to their hands-on approach, which eventually purged all Protestant religious teaching in Poland, and likely for several centuries. The kings of Poland, though they had to demonstrate a royal bloodline, were nonetheless elected by the Sejm, or they had, because they were elected as kings. They had to mind their P's and Q's. The king could not dismiss Parliament, nor was his election guaranteed because he was next in line for the throne. The divine right of kings did rule, but only by caveat. So into this still relatively medieval and yet curiously pre-modern kingdom was born Jan Laski, the youngest of five born into a noble house or noble family into what today it would be Western Poland. Laski, the word Laski in Polish literally means graces. Laska means grace, singular. Laski means graces, plural. Or it could mean of the woods. SKI is sort of like son, or Henderson, Hendrick's son. So SKI in the Slavic language is son of the woods, something like that. So we're not really sure what the real meaning here is. In later years, his brothers went on to become attendants at the court of Francis I, the King of France, and also at the court of the King of Hungary. And they were also closely tied to the political court of the Emperor, Charles V. That's the Holy Roman Emperor. We're talking about Central Europe here in the 1500s. Laski's fraternal uncle was a Roman Church Archbishop who eventually became the primate of Poland and was a friend of the then Pope. So while Jan's brothers found their place and later their demise in European politics, Jan, it was agreed, would be a son of the Church. He was taken under the wing of his uncle, Archbishop Andrew. He was homeschooled or tutored in Krakow, and then sent to Bologna in Italy to study theology at the university. The universities at the time were full of foment. Lectures still embraced the Aristotelian scholasticism of Aquinas, but in the cafeterias, students, including Jan, were all aflame with the new humanism. And that's the uncovering of ancient Greek and Roman texts heretofore unknown, and commentaries such as those by Ficino that attempted to explicate them. And that really was a kicker for the Reformation. Erasmus translated the New Testament, the Greek New Testament at the time, and so the scriptures were considered a part of this uncovering. They weren't really treated in a special way. They were just considered as ancient literature, but that's the thing. They got into the hands of the people, at first the priests, but then the people, and that was a big spur for the Reformation. Jan left the university early in Bologna because he lent money to a distant cousin also studying there for the cousin to pay off gambling debts. But the cousin kept the money instead of paying the debt, and Jan was a co-signer on the note. I guess he hadn't read the Book of Proverbs yet. Neither Jan's father nor Archbishop Andrew would fork over the money for repayment, perhaps thinking Jan was also involved, and so Jan had to leave Bologna without graduating. He returned to Poland, but wanderlust set in before the year was out, drawn by that humanism that was sweeping Europe at the time. He went to Basel in Switzerland, and there Laski met and befriended Erasmus, who had just published the Greek New Testament. Jan moved in with Erasmus, paying him a generous monthly stipend, and before he left, he purchased Erasmus's library under the magnanimous agreement that all the books remain resident with Erasmus until his death. Laski met some of the reformers in Basel, Erasmus's Greek New Testament being the chief draw. These included, I always have trouble pronouncing his name, Ecolampadius, who I think was one of the authors, along with Ursinus, of the Heidelberg Catechism. Although at the time, Ecolampadius was a Roman priest. Melanchthon, who was, as you may know, Luther's right-hand man, and Farel, whose lectures Jan attended until Farel was ousted from the city. The fiery Calvinist Farel visited Erasmus and Jan, but eventually branded Erasmus a modern Balaam, recalling Luther's assessment of Erasmus later on, that he led the children of God out of Egypt, but stopped short of taking them on into the promised land. Yes.
Is that a different pharaoh than
Gilliam? Gilliam.
Was that a different pharaoh that attracted Calvin to Geneva?
That's the same pharaoh. Am I pronouncing, my French is terrible. I think it's Gilliam Farrell. G-U-I-L-L-A-M-E. You bet. After about a year, Archbishop Andrew, by now the primate, summoned Jan home, but instructed him to make his way via the northern provinces of Italy. Uncle Andrew likely suspected the Protestant influences on Jan. And wanted to take him out of that environment. Jan eventually settled in Venice for 2 years, and under Uncle Andrew's oversight, became attached to the church there. His brother Stanislaus was also in Venice at the time, operating as a courtier for Francis I. So Jan returned to Poland in 1527, at the age of 26. What he didn't tell Uncle Andrew was that on his way to Venice, he stopped to visit Zwingli, who compelled Jan to study the Bible. Something we take for granted, but, people just didn't do that. So Jan started to study the scriptures. Before returning to Poland, Jan also visited Paris, where he acquired a copy of the sermons of Jacques Lefebvre, whom he'd also likely met, and also met Marguerite de Valois, the reformed sister of Francis I. So he was already pretty well acquainted with the reformed faiths, sidling up to it through humanist writings, but as we'll see, embracing it for himself. It's clear that at this time, Jan was coming to a place of reformation. But leaving the church was the last thing on his mind. If anything, embracing the reformational spirit endeared him more to the church than ever before, wanting to see her grow in holiness and to reform. And this, as was true for the other reformers, unfortunately could not last. In the next 4 years, Jan gained preferment under the watchful eye of Uncle Andrew. He was elevated to canon, then deacon, and then provost in the Roman Church. And when Uncle Andrew died in 1531, his ecclesiastical enemies came out of the woodwork, and Jan paid the price. His career advancement came to an abrupt halt. There was no separation of church and state as we understand it in Europe at the time. So Jan divided his time between church duties and with his brothers seeking to influence the courts in Hungary and France. The Laskys chose the wrong man for the Hungarian throne, and this reverberated through the family for years. So there are a number of things at this time that kind of went against them, but this also was a providential kind of turning point for Jan. In 1538, actually, little is known of Laski for the next decade or so, until about 1538. He likely continued reading Reformed literature, studying the scriptures, maintaining correspondence with like-minded friends in Switzerland and France. And Jan was on the outs with the church bishopric, but was a favorite of King Sigismund, who was still on the throne. And King Sigismund advanced him to archdeacon in the Warsaw Church, which is a different area of the country, effectively getting him out from under or out of the district of his uncle's enemies. And this was the critical point for Jan. Jan made an appointment with the king and basically said, thanks but no thanks. And the unexpected advancement was a providential turning. He told Sigismund he wanted to travel, at which point the king offered him a bishopric. And then Jan told him the real reason. He wasn't interested in continuing the Laski church dynasty. He wanted to be a simple preacher of the gospel. So Sigismund wasn't a religious persecutor, as Laski well knew, The king gave him letters of recommendation and let him go. And so here at the age of 37, Jan again leaves Poland, but this time, but he didn't go, you see, he didn't go to Wittenberg, he didn't go to Geneva, he didn't go to Zurich or Strasbourg, where Calvin was at the time, but where he went was to the book fair at Frankfurt am Main. And there's still an annual book fair there every year. It's pretty famous worldwide. And there he met someone who set him up in ministry in East Friesland. Today it's part of the Netherlands and Germany. So 6 years later, he would write the following to Bullinger, and it's a quote. I was once a Pharisee of repute, adorned with many titles and dignities, splendidly endowed with many and rich benefices from the days of my boyhood. But now, through the grace of God, after I have given up my country and my friends, because I saw I could not live in the midst of them according to Christ's mind and spirit, I am in a strange land, only a poor servant of my poor Lord Christ, crucified for me, lately here minister of the church, to make known the doctrine of the gospel, after the will of him who, of his compassion, has called me out of the net of the Pharisees into his flock. In 1539, the Netherlands was a hotbed of reformation. Queen Mary of the Netherlands was to protect the kingdom from encroaching Protestantism, but she was firmly, if discreetly, in its corner. Lasky joined one of the many cottage meetings that opened the Bible, discussed it, and prayed. These were the original Bible studies. Eventually, this meeting, with over 40 people attending, was rounded up and martyred, with Lasky and a few others escaping by the hair on their chinny-chin-chin. Lasky, the former Roman churchman, also took a wife in the Netherlands. East Friesland, now part of the Netherlands and Germany, had embraced Lutheranism at the time, and by 1528 had its own confession of faith. It was ruled by a regent, the wife of a recently deceased chieftain. Her name was Anne. Lasky came under the oversight of the bishops there, but within a year, with the church and Anne discerning his gifts and abilities, he was elevated to chief bishop. His first act was to go after the monks. He didn't throw them out of their cloisters, but appealed to them with the gospel, spending time in explaining the scriptures, and even won some over. For those who did not see things his way, they were allowed to stay in their cloisters, conduct prayer, and participate in almsgiving, but were otherwise denuded of all ministerial activity. And the statues had to go. This may sound harsh to modern ears and sensibilities, but it was really quite peaceful when compared to what had occurred in other kingdoms. England, for example. Anne at first objected. Her brother-in-law was strongly attached to the Roman Church, and East Friesland, he was a frequent visitor to the court of Charles V, etc. And East Friesland, technically speaking at least, was still part of the Holy Roman Empire. Lasky nonetheless prevailed through patient instruction of what he knew Anne already knew to be true. And it was a gamble, you see, and he won. And in the end, acquiesced, not to Lasky, but to the truth as she saw it. His humaneness toward the monks who were severely abused in other kingdoms no doubt helped. Lasky served the church in East Friesland from 1542 to 1549. He authored a catechism, developed church-wide preaching schedules for the clergy, and established schools already directly involved in the curriculum and methods of instruction. And when problems arose between the ministers and their congregations, he introduced the Censura Morum, a practice allowing the minister and congregation to speak freely in open meeting about anything heard unfavorably about the minister, and then allow discussion, investigation, and brotherly admonition. It's still part of the church order in many Dutch and German Reformed churches today, although it's changed, and I'll explain that in a moment. A century later, a Reformed Frisian minister said that the practice of censura morum long preserved concord and peace among ministers and their congregations, and that he learned more at these censura morum meetings than he did at university. So it's an interesting practice, and if you think about it, it's necessary because the scriptures tell us that we need to respect and obey our elders. And so we, you know, if there's an issue, there needs to be some kind of a vehicle for the church to address those who are in leadership. And it's very different in the Presbyterian churches, right? The Presbyterian churches are more procedural. So if I have a problem, I'm going to write it out and give it to the session as a complaint. And the complaint comes, the session takes it up. They either agree or disagree or have some place in the middle and meet with the person. Person unsatisfied? Presbytery. Still unsatisfied? General Assembly or Synod, right? That's very Presbyterian, very procedural, very English. But in the Dutch and German churches, they took all of that on right there in the congregation. So instead of the complaints, they say, censura morum. And the congregation would meet with the minister. Typically, the minister would step out of the room. There would be discussion, etc. The elders would lead it, but the congregation entirely would participate. And then they'd call them in, and then there'd be some kind of way of correction. And you can see the need for that is because the scriptures tell us, you know, to respect and to obey our elders. And so this is a way to get at that. In the Dutch and German churches today, censura morum has been kind of shrunken to what's called the consistory, which is the meeting of the deacons and the elders together. So it's not congregation-wide anymore. In consistory, if somebody has a problem, some consistories will just go around the room one by one. I'm not sure if that's so much going on anymore. But if there's one or two people with whom there's a problem, they're asked to leave the room during a meeting, and there's discussion, brotherly discussion, and then they call the person back into the room, and there's brotherly admonition. So that's still going on, although on a consistory basis rather than on a congregational basis. It's kind of interesting. He's the one who introduced that. Lasky was chief bishop but also pastor of the church in Emden, East Friesland's capital, and so subjected himself to the practice of censura morum himself, and eventually included the lay elders in it as well. He later introduced a practice in the stranger churches in London. This was a church or a number of congregations in England of continental refugees, French, German, Dutch, Czech, etc. A new challenge soon emerged in the Anabaptist Menno Simons, from which we get the denominational name Mennonites. Herman Dalton, Lasky's 19th century biographer, describes Simons as a leader, vigorous, sensible, and freedom-loving. He did embrace Gnostic elements, which became evident when he was cornered on the Incarnation. He was also a universal salvationist, what we would call a semi-Pelagian. Anabaptist enthusiasm on the continent had led to antinomian behavior and violence. So Simons, in response or reaction to this, emphasized a theology of holiness via complete removal from society. He tried to recast what Anabaptists were known for at the time, pervasive sourness, judgmentalism to the point of social disorder and violence. And if you know anything about early Reformation history, you know what I'm talking about. He invited, there were wars in the streets. You know. He invited Lasky, chief bishop, now of the National Church, to debate in Emden. And Dalton writes that the debate at the beginning seemed to have gone Simon's way. He was a native speaker, as well as an accomplished rhetorician who kept his audience rapt. One thing he was not, however, was a biblical expositor. He would begin with scripture, but soon, like much Anabaptist preaching at the time, would sail into waters of assertions and opinions and venomous invective. Lasky, in his broken Frisian, or I'm not really sure if it was Frisian or High German, was measured and theologically connective, making multiple references to scripture. And Menno's disciples celebrated after the event, thinking Simons had left Lasky in the dust. And, you know, there was much at stake here, because the way that the kingdom went, the way the kingdom went with the church is the church that would be the prominent church in the kingdom. But once Lasky answered Simons in print and the pamphlet was distributed throughout Europe, the Frisian Mennonites, if not regarded as heretics there at the time, were seen as kooks. And Simons left Emden, apparently seeking to more consistently practice his theology of societal removal. With
Simons issues, withdrawal from society, lifestyle.
I'm sure there's more involved. There's semi-Pelagianism. There's a kind of an equation of holiness with societal removal, right? So, you know, the view of holiness is not integrational, but rather geographical. I'm sure it's integrational as well, but it's geographical. So it's a form of German piety, what we would call German pietism. Lasky didn't seek to have Simons and his disciples removed from the kingdom, either before or after the debate. By the time Lasky's pamphlet was published, they'd self-relegated to their conclave meetings. Neither did he encourage laws for the Mennonites to not proselytize. He didn't shut them down. In fact, after a while, Lasky and the Countess Anne moved for their protection under law, since the sect was at points in danger. And people started taking it out on them. Anne and Lasky would not abide disorder and the inciting of social unrest, for which the Anabaptists at the time were universally known. And some of this arose after it became apparent that Simons had lost influence in the kingdom. Repeated incendiaries and criminal perpetrators justifying their acts by their religion were summarily exiled from the kingdom. Anne and Lasky agreed to allow sects so long as they were peaceful and law-abiding, and they'd enjoy the law's protection, as Bucer had also accomplished in Germany. And that's something that had not occurred in England until almost the 18th century. Kind of interesting. We went to lunch once with a Dutch couple, and the wife was not only Dutch, but Frisian. You could usually tell the Frisians, they have many vowels in their names. And usually they're right next to each other. I guess a super Frisian name would be Jarsma. I mean, it's only two syllables and it has three A's in it. You know, ends in an A, two A's in the middle. And we were talking about this, and I said, you know, Menno Simons, many people think he's German. He was actually Frisian. And well, she looked at me and she said, "That's not possible." Anne and Lasky agreed. Okay, we went through that. So there were squabbles over the Lord's table in Emden, with some clergy more Lutheran in their views. And here Lasky also gave room. According to Dalton, Lasky came close to Calvin and Cranmer in his view of the sacrament, apparently independently, even though he'd been previously influenced by the strict symbolist view of Zwingli. Lasky's view of the sacrament was that what it signified was also received spiritually, and that the entire administration of the sacrament from the beginning to the end was the sacrament itself. That's right. And more on that later if you want to discuss it. It's kind of interesting. It has to do with a processional theology, procession of the Holy Spirit. His view of spiritual reception was apparently enough for the Lutheran-leaning clergy, although Lasky did not believe in what can be called the real presence in consubstantiation, and so they stayed with the National Reformed Church. So that was really quite an accomplishment. Just as matters seemed to have finally settled down in East Friesland, Lasky was faced with the unexpected dictum of the interim passed into law by Charles V, defeating the German Protestant princes in 1547. Charles's interim was passed and enforced by the police state the following year. Rome didn't like it. It wanted things to go further. But Charles needed the German princes as allies, though decidedly on his terms. Protestant church buildings were returned to the Roman church. Protestants were able to worship, but were basically socially supplanted. Charles allowed former Roman priests who that had married to remain married until the Pope ruled on the issue, which the Pope didn't like either. The Pope thought that should be immediately taken care of. So this threw, as you might imagine, fledgling European Protestantism into disarray, creating a divide almost as we see in China, you know, between government-sanctioned and non-sanctioned churches. Lots of infighting, squabbling, and disruption. Lasky found himself on the side that would not accept the interim. He opted for England, from where he'd already received several invitations from Cranmer, as did Peter Martyr and Bucer. Countess Anne granted him a leave. It was a difficult time for him. He'd just lost his wife to childbearing, his sixth child, and the child also died. The Countess offered him a substantial departing gift, which he refused. And after leaving his children with a family in Bremen, Germany, he left for Edward VI's England, arriving there in 1551. Cranmer repeatedly sought help from both the Continental Reformed and the Wittenberg Lutherans, but the Wittenberg Lutherans didn't want to make the trip, whereas the Calvinists did. The Lutherans had, for the most part, resigned themselves to the interim policies, whereas the Calvinists had not. And Bucer and Peter Martyr lectured in Cambridge and Oxford, while Lasky mainly hung out with Cranmer in Lambeth Palace. Eventually, he'd be named chief bishop of the stranger churches in London, and again, congregations of continental reformed people who were in London, mainly to escape persecution, but possibly also for business. Cranmer and Lasky had a fraternal but at times tense relationship. Lasky almost certainly influenced Cranmer's view of the Lord's table, sweeping away in the archbishop's thinking any notion of real presence, which in some ways still beleaguered Wittenberg, and which Henry VIII, many people don't know this, but Henry VIII insisted on it, on real presence in the sacrament. Dalton says that Wittenberg's refusal to honor Cranmer's invitation and the Calvinist willingness to help set the Anglican Church on its ostensibly reformed path, making the Puritans and the Westminster Confession possibilities years later. Opinionated aristocrats like Seymour in Northumberland got involved with doctrinal discussions. These were advisors, direct advisors to the king, as did bishops Ridley and Hooper. At one point, Cranmer had Bishop Hooper sent to the Tower of London for his refusal to wear vestments. The differences were cultural between Cranmer and his foreign guests. The Continental Reformers tended to move forward, either winning or losing, and worked with the consequences of either, whereas highly parliamentary England, it seemed, was more bound to procedure, as I said earlier, due process and getting key people on board before moving forward with something. So where was Lasky in all of this? Well, pretty much in the thick of it. He worked with Cranmer, Peter Martyr, and for a while with John Knox on the Anglican Church's canon law, which would later become the 42 Articles, which would later become the 39 Articles. The Continental Reformers bristled at ceremonial liturgy, holding to one form or another of what's called the regulative principle. They found allies in Northumberland and the vestment divesting Hooper, but Cranmer, backed by Ridley, was sensitive to transitioning the English church to its new identity. And so he argued adiaphora, things indifferent in regard to ceremonies. And in the end, even Lasky and Bucer, though they remained lifelong friends, disagreed. They came to loggerheads, not over whether ceremonies should go or not. They both believed they should. But over whether to relent or not with Cranmer. So Bucer conceded, not theologically, but over the point of, he said, lack of maturity on the part of the English church. And so perhaps transitioning in this sense was the way to go, after all. Very interesting, and this book just came out this year. I forget the fellow's name. I think it's Palmer. Reformed histories are written from the top down. Right, the kings, the reformers, the main guys. This is a bottom-up book, history book. And I want to read it. I haven't gotten to it yet. It's about the common people. And there were wars in the streets in England. We talk about Anabaptists in Germany. 10,000 people in a county in Sussex, dead over whether the priests are wearing vestments or not, or whether it's Catholic or whether it's Anglican. So Ridley, had something going there, and Cranmer, in terms of transition, whereas the other guys from the continent, perhaps not culturally totally understanding what's going on there, took more of a hard line and wouldn't relent on it. So Lasky and Peter Martyr held their ground on the issue. They knew their place as guests, but would not be brought round to relinquish the regulative principle in worship as their hosts tried to convince them of doing. They agreed to disagree, remaining in England under Cranmer's hospitality and friendship, though they also often had heated disputes with the Archbishop, as you can imagine. All of that changed with the unexpected death of young Edward and the ascendancy of Bloody Mary. In 1553, Cranmer's foreign guests and the entire stranger church, all of the congregations, vacated, hightailed it for the continent. Lasky, with his new wife, a relative of William Cecil, who'd later be Elizabeth I's advisor, returned to Emden. Now, whether vestments should be or should not be worn didn't seem to much matter now, when all Protestant parties, pro and con, were led to the stake under Mary Stuart. After 3 years in Emden, he's Mary Tudor. I'm sorry, you're right. Yeah, wrong century. After 3 years in Emden, East Friesland, Lasky returned to Poland under King Sigismund's protection, where for the rest of his life he'd work to unite sectarian Protestantism. Previous successes in East Friesland, where he was able to keep the Lutherans in the fold of the National Reformed Church, may have encouraged him to try. This was tough work, tougher than he thought it would be. By close to the end of his life, the Bohemian Brethren, that was a Lutheran group, and the Polish Calvinists were on the verge of uniting. And then Lasky died at the age of 61. And the union evaporated with no one of his stature and gifts to carry it on. So Protestant sectarianism continued and no doubt contributed to the Counter-Reformation's success in that area of Europe. Lasky is perhaps best known for the man that he influenced, and that's Abraham Kuyper. Kuyper was, with access to Lasky's work in Latin, wrote his doctoral dissertation on Lasky, and both Lasky and Calvin's views of the church, and later published a critical edition of Lasky's works. Kuyper wrote, and here's a quote, "Whenever I recall the seeking love of my God, I go back continually to the remembrance of that marvelous providence of the Laskiana," means the works of Lasky, and he means the providence of how God led him to Lasky's work and its influence on his faith and later ministry. It's interesting how God takes a man and, without changing his personality, but bending or redirecting it, deploys this man for his own purposes. We see this with Paul. We see this with Aquinas, with Augustine, excuse me. We see this with Luther. Men with bents, even quirks, we could say, that were both commendable and less than commendable, wholly taken up by the Lord and used for his design in the church and in the world. And Lasky also had his predispositions. He was a nobleman's son who could have risen to the top of any ladder in his own country. He gave all that up. He gave up his homeland to follow Christ into the ministry. And as a nobleman's son, he had the privilege to have received a stellar education, one thing used by God, but he also had a carriage that is largely unpopular today, I think, not only generally, but even in the church. And but it was of great use in the 16th century when needing to get things done. And Lasky, I'm going to say, had presence, something easily misinterpreted today as haughtiness. He moved and commanded respect, not only in his own, but in other cultures, not because he thought it was owed him, but because he had the gifts, the talents, the presence to use them toward the goals of gospel preaching, church order, church unification. He was a leader, though not the kind that leads a pack. Instead, he dedicated himself to ensuring that the pack followed the right leader, who is Christ. His work largely entailed ironically and tirelessly pointing people in the right direction. His trips all over Europe, some for extended stays, demonstrate not a vacation mindset to which the nobility were given, or merely the curiosity of the perpetual student, but a deliberate purpose, sometimes successful, sometimes not, but always with a goal. Wanderlust, then, too, can be a bent used by God for purposes greater than the enjoyment of the traveler. Though not well known and quite satisfied to remain behind the scenes himself, Lasky's influence in the Dutch, German, and English churches is greater than most surmise. One Reformation historian, Diarmid McCullough, believes that his behind-the-scenes underground work, combined with his willingness to travel and patiently park in other nations to see the work done, likely made him a more influential reformer than Calvin. Who can tell? So that's Jan Lasky. If you have any questions, if we have time for any, or any discussion, I'm happy to entertain that. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sure Jerry would be available informally to answer any questions, perhaps after the services today. Smith and